You are listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is, of course, when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week in our region and quite a bit of news to get to. Today, our panel includes Heath Druzin, reporting fellow with Guns in America at Boise State Public Radio, Margaret Carmel, reporter with BoiseDev.com, and Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News. Hey there, everybody.
Hey, Gemma.
Hey.
So let's start with Governor Little rolling back Idaho, I guess, to phase three-ish earlier this week. Kevin, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, it's kind of somewhere between stage three and stage four. But what Governor Little did was take the state back in terms of its coronavirus reopening plan. And what this really affects is size of gatherings. The governor believes that the biggest problem right now is with weddings, funerals, gatherings of those types, social gatherings, family gatherings, even gatherings at bars, because one of the things that this rollback does is it doesn't close bars, it doesn't close nightclubs, it just requires that everybody, all the patrons are seated. But, you know, listening to the piece in the open, Jimmy Dawson's piece, I mean, it nails it. I mean, this did not go over very well. Conservatives in the legislature, Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan, were very quick to criticize it. You would expect that. They've been very critical of the governor's positions on the coronavirus response since the spring. What also came out this time around was the Idaho Education Association, which endorsed Governor Little back in 2018, they panned the move. They don't think that it's going to make schools any safer. The social media outcry that I saw, the backlash on social media, it came from a lot of folks who said, we need the governor to do something more here. And that goes back to the ongoing debate about whether the state should institute a mask mandate. And that came through a lot on Tuesday when the governor fielded questions at NAARP Idaho telephone town hall, people saying, you have to do more. You know, the local officials are not doing enough. These half measures are just not getting it done. So not a very popular move.
And Heath, that goes to, you know, what the governor did, as Kevin mentioned, about these public gatherings. You track the COVID numbers for Boise State Public Radio that we put on our website. And I mean, I think to put it mildly, this was not a good week.
No, it wasn't. That personal responsibility the governor keeps asking for, he's not finding it, to be brutally honest. Idaho's not being responsible, and our numbers reflect that. We're in the worst stretch of the pandemic that we have been since the first case in mid-March. That's a long time, and you know, everybody's feeling it. They know it's been a long time. So yeah, you know, as Kevin said, it's kind of interesting. This move seemed to please nobody. It was kind of a half measure that had a little bit for everybody to be upset about. And it's not really clear what it's going to do to put a dent in those numbers. You know, he keeps deferring to local health districts, but the local health districts in some cases seem resistant to enforcing anything. And in other cases, you know, it seems like they're really looking for leadership from him. So it seems to be kind of ping-ponging between local governments and local districts and the governor, and kind of seems to be a hot potato. Like nobody really wants to take the lead on this.
You know, and it
right.
Feels,
I mean, oh, go ahead, Kevin.
You know, and it feels politically like the governor's message is almost at odds with his actions. I mean, to the governor's credit, he is being candid about the situation. He is saying this is a crisis. He was flanked by hospital officials on Monday who laid out the crisis in very clear terms. I mean, this is a stark contrast to what we're seeing from the president, who is downplaying this, calling it a fake news conspiracy that will go away next week. At least the governor, unlike the president, is not lying about the situation at hand. But at the same time, I think as he talks about it being a crisis, I think you also have Idahoans saying, well, if it's a crisis, why are we still talking about personal responsibility? Why are we still talking about local decision making? Why aren't we doing more at the state level?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's fair to say, Heath and Kevin, that, I mean, you both bring up the point that it's the governor puts it on the shoulders of local, right, of the health districts. The health districts are like, they would rather have the governor make the decision. So it does seem very political, where no one wants to say like, yeah, I'm it, and I'll make a blanket decision.
I was struck too. I'm sorry, Heath, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, I think he's trying to thread this needle that I think it's becoming very apparent that you can't thread during a once in a 100-year pandemic. You know, it's an emergency situation, and it's kind of hard to split the difference. And I think we kind of see that in the numbers right now.
I was struck too on Monday that the timing, as the governor was announcing the rollback to stage three, the Coeur d'Alene City Council was meeting to discuss a mask mandate to basically, you know, kind of pick up after the Panhandle Health District had dropped a mask requirement for Kootenai County. And I listened to a little bit of that meeting online before the governor's presser, and you had people chanting, "No more masks, we will not comply." Look, I mean, the weight of the world is on the governor's shoulders here. I get that, and I wouldn't dispute that for a second. But you've got these local officials who are having to stare down some very angry people and having to make decisions at the local level with COVID deniers and skeptics and critics right in their face.
This is definitely a politically challenging situation for local officials. I see that playing out a lot in Boise. Mayor McLean was one of the first officials to close restaurants. You know, she closed restaurants and bars prior to the governor's stay-at-home order. And since then, her order has been superseded by actions taken by Central District Health and, you know, kind of larger entities, you know, putting in these mask mandates. We've got restaurants open, we've got bars open. But I regularly still see comments online of people saying businesses are struggling because of Mayor McLean, referring to her as a communist, a socialist, and just kind of fueling a really ugly viewpoint of, mm-hmm. you know, her administration, Commissioner Diana Lacciando, who sits on Central District Health and is up for re-election on Tuesday, has also just gotten a wave of complaints and allegations of being a socialist. You know, I think local officials are realizing that anyone that really decides to take some stricter actions to try to curb the spread of the virus will face the consequences either, you know, online, at the ballot box. There's some really intense anger over this issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then on top of all that, I mean, let's just be clear about the numbers, shall we? I mean, Kevin, last week, the Utah Medical Association went to their governor saying that they are to a point where they are going to potentially need to triage care. And what that means is you pick and choose who to save and who not to save. I mean, it's as simple as that. And our medical experts, we do, as folks know, if you're a regular listener, every Wednesday we bring in medical experts. Dr. Pate, who sits on the coronavirus task force, said that Idaho may not be too far behind if we don't get a handle on this. And Kevin, our hospitalization rates are alarming right now.
You know, really all of the numbers are alarming right now. There's hardly anything to look at that's encouraging. We're probably going to set another weekly peak in terms of new cases. This is already the deadliest 7-day period that we've seen in the pandemic, as Heath was mentioning, and those hospitalization rates. You know, why do we keep focusing on the case numbers? We focus on them because, as we've seen over and over in this pandemic, when you've got a spike in case numbers, unfortunately, a couple of weeks out, you have pressure on hospitals, just like you're talking about that they're seeing in Utah. And when you have increase in hospitalizations, tragically, a couple of weeks down the road, you see another increase in deaths. I mean, based on the numbers we're seeing right now, we're looking at some grim hospitalization rates and some potentially some grim numbers in terms of mortality for the next several weeks.
And then, Kevin, you mentioned this in the beginning of our conversation about Idaho GOP lawmakers when Governor Little pushed us back into phase three. They made a video with the Idaho Freedom Foundation, and some of them basically even questioning if this virus is real. But then there's Lieutenant Governor Janice McKeon, who, I mean, she had a Bible and she had a gun. And even watching this video goes back to, you know, you see that polarization politically.
Well, Janice McKeon covered all the bases in that video. She had a Bible, she had a gun, there was the flag on the back of the SUV. If she's not running for governor, she's certainly doing a really good impersonation of somebody who is planning to run for governor. And she has been the face of the opposition to the governor's coronavirus response since the spring. You know, that video, it did come out on Tuesday. The Freedom Foundation said it had been in the works for a while, but clearly, you know, the timing, you know, it doesn't take a master sleuth to figure out that the timing was somewhat a reaction to Monday's news.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable right after this. You're listening to Idaho Matters, and we're continuing our reporter roundtable. Our panel, Heath Drusen, reporting fellow with Guns in America at Boise State Public Radio, Margaret Carmel, reporter with BoiseDev.com, and Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News. So I'm sure all of you are aware we are 4 days away from the general election. And to say, yeah, what? What's going on?
Is there something happening?
Yeah, there's this little thing called an election coming up. Yeah. I just wanted to let you guys know, in case you just haven't been following it. But Heath, you have been doing, I think, some really interesting reporting on armed militia groups. Can you talk about this? Because there are some, I mean, we've heard about voter intimidation, these ideas of maybe post-election violence, but you really went out and found one of these groups and talked with them.
Yeah, I was actually, I was on Whidbey Island, Washington, which is about an hour north of Seattle, and I was at a protest. It was more of a rally, but it was labeled as a protest against lockdown orders there, and it was organized by the Washington 3%. And a lot of folks here might be familiar with the Real 3%ers of Idaho, led by Eric Parker. This is their counterpart in Washington, and their leader Matt Marshall there actually is kind of in the same, kind of from the same philosophical school as Eric Parker. He was leading a protest. It was a bunch of folks who gathered to specifically protest restrictions on church gatherings that had to do with COVID, but it certainly ran the gamut and was, you know, a lot of sort of far right views on what government should and shouldn't be able to do. Now, a big part of the reason I was there is because there's a lot of experts who are very worried about people showing up to the polls armed and potentially intimidating voters. So, you know, that's something that a lot of you know, even attorneys general around the country are kind of bracing for.
Mm-hmm. And when you were looking at this, Heath, I mean, there are specific states too, correct? Where recent study is suggesting that they are the most at risk, and the closest to us is Oregon. So it's Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Oregon. And you were in Washington, but you know, we're talking the West right there, the Pacific Northwest. Did you, what were your takeaway? What were your feelings from covering this?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's definitely a split in the so-called Patriot movement, which includes militias. It includes far-right groups like Patriot Prayer, who are, that's the group that's been, they do a lot of brawling in Portland with left-wing protesters. If you've seen video from Portland. And there's a real split, you know. The leader of the 3% in Washington, who I spoke to, specifically said, I don't want my followers anywhere near the polls unless they're voting. He very much rejected any kind of freelance poll watching. But the leader of Patriot Prayer, Joey Gibson, he absolutely wouldn't say that, and kind of made it sound like his guys would be out in force after the election if they felt like there was an unfair result against Donald Trump. So that's exactly what people are worried about. They're worried about armed people coming to the polls and scaring away voters, and they are worried about these same folks potentially, having clashes if they think that that the election was rigged. And the guys I talked to, no matter what they thought about coming to the polls armed, they all kind of assumed that there would be some kind of chicanery, and that there would be violence after the election. Mm. Now, they say they would take defensive positions, but they also predicted that they would be, potentially defending their communities. And I think that sounds a lot of alarm bells for people.
And we should note that, yes, the presidential election is getting, the majority of coverage, and is top of mind for so many people. But Kevin, every state, including Idaho, has some pretty critical races that people should be aware of. And I know that you put an article out earlier that really breaks it down. But can you talk a little bit about that? Because, it's not like you get your ballot and all it says, who do you want for president?
Right. There are a lot of important races on this ballot. I mean, you've got the congressional races, you've got a U.S. Senate race and the two congressional races, but you drill down to the local level. Margaret alluded to it, and she's been covering this much more closely than I have, the county commission races, Diana Lachiando's race against Ryan Davidson, the other Ada County Commission race. We tried to focus in a little bit this week on some of the legislative races that could have a real impact on education policy or on state policy. And if you wanted to look at one area, if you're stressed and pressed for time on election night, look at District 15. It's the legislative district in West Boise. The House seats flipped from Republican to Democrat 2 years ago. Fred Martin, the senator in that district, was reelected by 6 votes. It is a swing district. It is probably the most competitive legislative district in the state. And Republicans want to try to flip those House seats back. Former House member Patrick McDonald is running, hoping to unseat first-term Democrat Steve Birch. Democrats want to flip that Senate seat. They feel like they have a competitive race and a very spendy race by legislative election standards. In that Senate race in District 15, Fred Martin chairs the Senate Health and Welfare Committee, which could be a very important committee in the 2021 session in the middle of a pandemic. So if you are looking for one legislative district to watch, and there are a bunch of legislative races that are worth watching, mm-hmm. but the one to focus on is District 15.
And then, Margaret, I do want to talk about what you mentioned earlier, and Kevin mentioned it, with the Ada County Commission race, in particular, some big money from PACs being pushed towards more conservative candidates.
Yeah, there's been major spending in the Ada County November election, both at the commission level and even trickling down to the Ada County Highway District. Home builders, construction companies, and kind of their affiliates have been donating a lot, either to conservative candidates in certain cases, like former state senator Rod Beck got a lot of donations directly from construction companies. Ryan Davidson, the Republican candidate to face off with Diana Lachiando, did not get so many individual donations, but there is a PAC called Conservative Citizens for Thoughtful Growth that is powered by a lot of construction company money that was running some really intense attack ads against Commissioner Lachiando on Facebook that were garnering hundreds of comments from people referring to her as a socialist, attacking her. It was a very kind of, I scrolled through the comments and people were very angry, and the ad was really not about growth issues. It was focusing on her support for low-income housing, quote unquote, crazy green ideas, other things like that. Lachiando alleges that money is kind of the construction companies getting back at her for leading the way on starting to charge impact fees in Ada County for the first time, which require developers basically to pay extra money whenever they build a project to the county in order to help pay for the infrastructure for that, like the sewer, first responders, roads for ACHD. You know, basically these impact fees, the concept is that growth pays for itself. But then people who are opposed to impact fees will say, okay, I'll pay this impact fee and I'll just turn around and hike up the price of the house I'm selling. So there's kind of different views on that. I did a pretty deep dive into the money. I tried to reach out to several of these big donors. Jim Conger was one of them. The PAC for the Idaho Building Contractors Association, and some builders with Tradewinds Building. And I wasn't able to connect with any of them directly about their frustrations with La Chiondo. So it's a little bit fuzzy exactly what their exact frustrations with her are, but they are putting a lot of resources into removing her from office.
And I think, Margaret, to note, I mean, when you talked about these attack ads that they did on Commissioner La Chiondo, what stood out for me is it wasn't that they necessarily just attacked her policies, which that is completely fair, right? You don't agree with someone's policies or what they've implemented or not implemented. That's fair game. When you call someone crazy, which is what these attack ads did, that crosses a line, especially when it is a female in office and these are misogynistic, patriarchal ideas that women who are trying to break glass ceilings have had to deal with and tolerate for time and eternity. And that is what struck me. And I'm curious, when you looked at the comments, Margaret, were there anyone bringing those issues up about, you know, attacking character versus attacking, you know, policy and not liking that?
Well, I'll say I agree with you. These ads were very personal in nature, but this election in this entire race on both sides has been very personal. La Chiondo has had a lot of negative comments against her character. She's had threats, armed protesters at her house all summer. It's been very intense, and the ads were actually removed. But I will say, in fairness, there have been some very negative comments, personal comments against Ryan Davidson as well. This race is just ugly. I just had to shut down the comment section in our community Facebook group discussing this race, because the comments were full of people attacking La Chiondo and also attacking Ryan Davidson's personal, like his appearance. Someone using some very lewd language to describe him, someone telling stories about an interaction that they had with him on a dating app that I was, you know, unable to confirm. It's a very ugly personal race, and there really hasn't been a lot of discussion in these comments, in these ads, about policy. It's been down in the mud brawling about personalities.
We are going to take another break. When we come back, we're going to start the conversation off with what evictions are looking like in the midst of the pandemic. Margaret's got some numbers on that. Continuing with our reporter roundtable today, Heath Drusen, reporting fellow with Guns in America at Boise State Public Radio, Margaret Carmel, reporter with Boise Dev, and Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News. Margaret, we know that evictions have been top of mind for a lot of folks during the pandemic, but there are some new numbers out, data numbers out, that actually go back to last year before the pandemic. And this is not an issue that is just because of the pandemic.
Right. So evictions in Idaho is a subject that we didn't really know much about until recently because of the way that the state categorized these types of cases in court. Up until mid-2018, it was impossible to know how many evictions there were because they just weren't classified separately. And now Boise State University's Idaho Policy Institute was able to go back and get these 2019 numbers and for the first time have a complete and accurate picture of how many people were formally evicted in Idaho and where they were and get a really good number. And what they came out to is there was an average of 4.4 evictions per day in 2019. And really what this tells us is it's a good baseline to know kind of where we're at as a state and as a community. So then at the end of 2020, they can do another analysis and see how big was the spike for evictions in 2020, which has been a major concern. Now, evictions are really important and because what happens when someone is evicted, especially in a very tight housing market like we have in Idaho, it makes it really difficult for them to get approved for a new apartment or a new place to live. And also it opens up this possibility of small claims courts, suits from landlords, which could mean a person owes a ton of court fees, they have to pay back a ton of damages, and their wages get garnished, because usually if someone's getting evicted for not paying rent, they already didn't have the money to pay their rent, and then they get turned around and get their wages garnished. And so it kind of can turn into this vicious cycle. And in recent years, a lot of housing advocates and sociologists have been studying the issue of evictions closely, because it can kind of indicate how a community is doing.
And Kevin, can we talk about, so we know, I mean, with evictions and how that's working, but then another issue that we've seen impacted by the coronavirus is education. And, you know, yes, I mean, parents have talked anecdotally about this. I mean, you know, it is a concern. However, there is now some data to back this up, because some reading scores have come back.
Right. This was the first big data set that we got from the fall of 2020. And really, not surprisingly, the numbers are lower. This is the Idaho Reading Indicator. And this is a screener that K-3 students take at the beginning of the school year so their teachers can get a sense of what they need to work on, what students are struggling with reading, what students are at risk of falling further behind. And the overall IRI scores for this fall are the lowest we've seen in 6 years. And where I see the drop-offs most significantly are in first, second, and third grade. The fall numbers for this year compared to the fall of the previous year. And it tells you that students coming back to school after the truncated school year, after having to spend the spring at home, studying at home, online, are coming back not as prepared, not as ready to read at grade level as students were a year ago. Not really a surprise, but it is an alarm bell as we head into the school year, and it gives you a sense of how much work teachers are going to be having to do trying to get students to grade level so they don't fall further behind.
And I think it's interesting, Kevin. I mean, I have a third grader and he took that test. And, you know, he lives in a home where we read, where we're incredibly privileged, right? He has every advantage. Yet his score was surprising to us, because it wasn't where it would have been, I believe, if he had been in traditional school, you know, until the end of May. So I can't imagine for these parents who don't even come close to having the privilege that my child has and what they're dealing with. And then you see how they're struggling.
Teaching a child to read is a difficult thing to do. That sounds like an obvious statement, but I think you have to keep that in mind. This is tough to do, and it's tough for teachers to do it. You know, the trained professionals, not parents, the trained pros who know how this works. It's a difficult thing to do, and it is so foundational to everything that students are expected to do beyond third grade. So these numbers aren't surprising, but they are sobering.
And then, Kevin, you're going to have, I believe, a story out later today, correct, about Boise State University. We know that there were furloughs in the spring, and now we're going to potentially be seeing more.
Right. So actually, this is a story I published on Thursday. It's an update of a story that Jimmy Dawson broke for you all a few days ago. For the first time in at least 20 years, Boise State is going to institute faculty furloughs. And it's a little bit like the staff furloughs that Boise State instituted in the spring. It's going to hit faculty members at the top end of the pay scale. They're going to have to take more furlough days. But it's really just, it's another sign of the financial challenges that Boise State is facing between lost revenue going back to the spring when the campus closed, the financial fallout from a shortened football season and a fan-free football season, the cost of getting the campus ready for reopening this fall, and the state budget cuts, all of those factors leading to some really difficult financial challenges facing Boise State and the faculty furloughs. We're talking about $1 million or so that the university hopes to save. You know, it's another piece of the puzzle as this university is facing some sudden and maybe unexpected hard times.
And then in the midst of what the university dealing with that, Kevin, a bit of a controversy around a coffee shop coming to campus.
Yes, there is. Big City Coffee opened a coffee shop in the library at the beginning of the semester. They're no longer on the campus, and it depends on, you know, which version of the story you want to adhere to. The university says that Big City Coffee asked to get out of its contract and get out of its lease, and the university honored that request. The Idaho Freedom Foundation has taken up this issue and has said that, in effect, Big City Coffee was pushed out by students who are upset because the owner of Big City Coffee is very pro-law enforcement. Her fiancé was paralyzed in an on-duty shooting a few years ago in Boise. So this becomes a hot button issue, and it becomes another hot button issue regarding values, the culture wars on campus, if you will. So, you know, it may sound like it's a tempest in a coffee cup, but it really fits into a larger narrative and a larger debate that we've seen at the State House over the past year or so, and in state circles, really, for the 16 months that Marlene Trump has been president at Boise State, about values and about campus culture. So it fits into a larger narrative. I suspect we'll continue to see this as another flashpoint in an ongoing debate.
And we should note that this morning there has not a rally outside of the big city coffee in the Linden District in downtown Boise, but people coming out in support of the Blue Lives Matter. And pictures, I've seen them on social media this morning. I mean, showing people, standing outside around the block, which is normal for that coffee shop, I think it's fair to say. The one thing that is noticeable, though, is the lack of social distancing. And at least in the pictures that I have seen so far, very few people, wearing masks. So here we are with the worst numbers that we've seen, and seeing a gathering, which is what the governor was trying to eliminate with his rollback on Monday.
Are you saying that they weren't being personally responsible, Gemma?
Hey, you know what? I was just looking at the pictures, Heath. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy.
So there you have it. Hey, I want to thank all of you for coming in today and spending this time with us. Always appreciate your guys' perspective, the reporting that you do. We have been talking with Heath Drusen, reporting fellow with Guns in America at Boise State Public Radio, Margaret Carmel, reporter with BoiseDev.com, and Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News. Happy Friday, everybody. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. Mask up,
Gemma.
Everyone.
Peace out.
Yeah, mask up. Thanks, Margaret. More Idaho Matters next.